I'm talking with Tom Moon and Rob Armstrong about John Coltrane. Tom Moon, is it possible to identify milestones and what launched him? What were his breakthroughs?
Well, very early on, he had many experiences. He played in big bands. He played R&B music. Before he starts to make records under his own name, he has almost every possible type of jazz experience. He plays behind singers here. He plays in cocktail lounge trios. He plays a lot of different music. So he's very much getting the sort of under-the-belt experience of how to play the saxophone in these settings. Then, as he starts to grow, as his music matures, his own playing, he then gets opportunities to play with people like Dizzy Gillespie, Jimmy Heath's big band, and ultimately Miles as the sort of catalyst to take him from one sort of level of awareness as a coming improviser to another level. But even that, you know, it's often said, oh, you know, he gets with Miles and then his career just shoots off. But actually, the way his thing worked was he was with Miles, but then he was also in this wonderful group with Thelonious Monk, not too distant in a time way. And then Miles fires him because of his heroin addiction. So to answer your question in terms of periods, I see that whole beginning phase that I just described as really his early work and his gathering of experience work. Then
that's the late 40s.
That's right. And then
right after the war,
as he develops his language, improvisational language, he grows through the experiences with Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie,
Johnny Hodges.
Right, Johnny Hodges' band. For Coltrane, that was a huge deal because Johnny Hodges was a preeminent saxophonist of the day and an idol of Train's. Train really loved his playing. So, you know, anytime you get the chance to work with someone like that, you grow simply because your energy is so activated. And that happened to him over and over again. In the period of a few years in the late 50s, he goes from Johnny Hodges to Dizzy to Miles to the group with Thelonious Monk that plays at the Five Spot for a long duration of 57 and into 58 is, I think, a real transformative time for him because obviously Monk has his own musical language and Train figures out a way to fit what he does into that. And that launches, I think, his Coltrane's own compositional efforts, which start to bear fruit shortly after he starts recording under his own name.
I completely agree with everything Tom said, but I think it's really interesting and probably not coincidental that the first album on Prestige Records that comes out under his own name comes out, he records it Memorial Day weekend of 1957, which is only a couple months after he kicks heroin for the last time. And, you know, all sources say that he never went back on it. That was when he was 30. And from then on, from the time he's 30 until he passes away at the untimely age of 40 in 1967, he's recording all the time and touring a lot.
Is it possible to distill this kind of evolution?
The eras?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I think so to a degree. Although, you know, when you were talking about people noticing him at the time of Giant Steps as such a blazing fast player, there's plenty of recordings of him playing with Miles where he's blazing fast and playing passages that are basically built on major and minor scales, but so fast that you can't even discern the individual notes. He's pursuing a way of playing that is built on the bebop model that Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and people like that perfected. He learns that language pretty well. He gets that to where it's somewhat under his fingers, and then he keeps going, and he wants to develop that further. And Miles, at that moment, is looking at ways to sort of decouple the harmony of bebop, which is very fast and moving in kind of stepwise progression all the time, from the technique of these kind of licks, if you will, or stock phrases. And Coltrane recognizes that the stock phrases don't cut it for him anyway. And his own pursuit and study is taking him toward something that is just different from what everyone else is doing. Ultimately, he's faster. And, you know, we talk a lot about the flashiness of his technique, but also he's more lyrical. He's figuring out a way to use these massive long lines and big ideas and lots of notes to express something that's ultimately just beautiful, and you don't have to know anything about jazz to respond to it as sheer art beauty. And he was doing that before he got to Miles. What you see after this period with Miles is him exploring a way to his own language of writing. His compositional style that doesn't necessarily come out of Monk or even share many similarities with Monk, but it's him. And you see that on the great record Giant Steps, which is an example of jazz music that's written almost out of an exercise. It is as though the songs on that record, 26-2, Countdown, and Giant Steps, are all essentially harmonic minefields. And they take the musician through a progression of chord sequences that are enormously different from bebop. You see him go from, Coltrane go from someone who's a talented improviser and someone who can bring lyricism to a standard like I'm Old Fashioned or something like that, blossoming into, through his dedicated practice and exploration, someone who's doing that compositionally. And he does that over and over again. Around the same time as Giant Steps, he records an album called Coltrane Plays the Blues, where he's written 10 or 12 blues heads that follow the 12-bar form in form, but harmonically they're very different, and they take interesting twists and turns and stuff like that. So there's that whole period. And when people refer to sheets of sound, that is, I think, this notion of how fast he played and how much harmony he covered in a short amount of time. So from there, it's interesting because then he, at that right around that same era, you mentioned My Favorite Things. And even then, at a time when jazz was really in the mainstream of culture, it was rare to have a hit. And he embraces the soprano saxophone, which is an unusual instrument, really hadn't been played in any great shakes since Sidney Bechet at the very beginning of the history of jazz. And he creates this thing out of a show tune that is just winsome and open and lyrical, and just, he's having fun. And you hear in that record, you hear the band having fun. And the people playing with him are not, they might be playing at a very high intellectual level, but there is pleasure in it.
He's not really changing. It sounds like he's expanding.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the before we get to Ascension, though, we have this very clear spiritual period, which is connected to his life change when he finally quits heroin. And he feels very much, as he wrote in the liner notes to A Love Supreme, which is the album that best encapsulates his spiritual work, that he was given the chance to, he was given kind of a rebirth, and he wants to use the opportunity wisely. He wants to, you know, provide uplift through music. And the way he does that most overtly is on A Love Supreme and through those songs that he's written for that record. He was in this for something more than money and fame and ego-related stuff. He was one of those people who was just on the track to take what his gift was and push it as far as he could. And that pushed it, that sent him into not only the different stylistic worlds that we're talking about, but innovative ways of playing, notions of trying to play two and three notes at once, notions of using the saxophone, overblowing and getting all these weird harmonies. Before that, sheets of sound, the notion of how fast can you play something that's a common line and have it come out sounding like something startling and innovative just by what you surround it with and how you shape it and how you color it. And all of that stuff adds up to what can happen if you are dedicated to something that is bigger than yourself.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.